Golden Trail. This is the first in a series entitled The Sourdough Speaks, a series of conversations about the early days and development of interior Alaska and the Fairbanks area. The University of Alaska Broadcasting Service and Alaska Communication Arts bring you this series of conversations and interviews. In The Sourdough Speaks, you will hear pioneers of interior Alaska tell you their experiences as they lived through the earliest period of development and settlement in the great valleys of the Tanana and Yukon Rivers, that area of Alaska called the interior. In this first program of the series, The Golden Trail, Neville Jacobs and Tom Duncan relate the story of the first great gold rushes that brought men north. You will learn the background of events that sent men in the quest of fortune in the north, and you will hear one of the Northland's earliest pioneers, Tony Trocheff, speak of his experiences from the Chilkoot Trail to Fairbanks. The settlement of the interior of Alaska really begins with that great gold rush to the Klondike, the first great rush to the far north.
Wait a minute. You said the Klondike strike was the first to bring men to the north.
Yes.
Well, actually, the Klondike was the great strike of 1898. But there were plenty of men here before then. They came up from British Columbia after the Cassiar strike in the 1860s, which followed the California strike of 1849.
Actually, if you go back far enough, the history of Fairbanks and the settling of interior Alaska is part of that story that begins in the 1500s. The quest for gold in the New World, when Coronado trekked across Mexico and the present-day American Southwest, looking for the legend of El Dorado.
Well, yes, but the first strike of major proportions in the far west was the California strike of 1849, when gold was discovered in the Sacramento Valley. Some of the gold seekers made fortunes, but others continued to prospect and turn northward. They moved up through Oregon Territory and into British Columbia.
There was a big strike on the Stikine River in British Columbia in 1861, and then the Cassiar District was discovered in 1871. Several thousand men rushed to these mining fields. They kept pushing northward, generally following the rivers, the Luce and the Pelly, until they reached the basin of the Yukon River. The Yukon rises in northwestern Canada and flows through Alaska westward, creating the basin of interior Alaska. To reach the headwaters of the Yukon, some miners traveled up the Stikine River, which enters the sea near Wrangell in southeastern Alaska. Then they crossed the divide and moved northward. Other miners stayed in the coastal waters and prospected creeks flowing into the sea from the island archipelago.
One of the most important discoveries of gold was made on the coast in 1880 by two prospectors, Richard Harris and Joe Juneau. Their discovery led to the famous Alaska Juneau and Treadwell mines. And, of course, the town of Juneau is the capital of Alaska.
The mines around Juneau are hard rock or lode mines. The gold comes directly from the mountain, you might say. But in the interior, men wash the gold from gravel in rivers and streams, that is, placer mining. Here, erosion has washed the gold out of the mountain into the creeks, where it is deposited with gravel and sand and worked down to the bottom and concentrates. So in the 1880s, following the Juneau strike and the Cassiar, men moved on over the mountains to the creeks flowing into the Yukon. In 1884, a discovery was made in this country known as the 40 Mile, a district spreading along the Yukon over the Alaska-Canada border. Miners were already nearby on the Stewart River, a tributary of the Yukon, so when the 40 Mile discovery was made, there was a small rush at that time. Then, in 1893, a rich discovery was made in Alaska on Birch Creek. And by 1894, Circle City on the Yukon was a bustling frontier gold town that served the Birch Creek mines.
Right. A lot of people don't realize that there was a great deal of mining activity in Alaska before the Klondike. But it was the Klondike that brought in thousands of men in a rush for gold that was unlike anything history had ever seen before. Men appeared to be lined in a solid stream over the Chilkoot Pass and along the trail that led from the sea across the mountains to the Yukon Basin. And this line of men, like a column of ants, kept moving over the trail for many months, pouring into valleys along the creeks of the Yukon.
In a way, the story of the Klondike strike itself starts in the early 1890s with a man named George Carmack. Carmack was a Californian who sailed to Alaska on a man of war. He left the ship at Juneau to prospect, and then made his way up the Lynn Canal to Dyea. Dyea was an Indian trading camp at the base of the Chilkat Trail. At Dyea, Carmack met and married an Indian woman from the upper Yukon. He returned to her land with her. On the Yukon, Carmack had a small cabin that served as a trading post, and he camped and fished during the summer with her relatives along the banks of the Yukon.
In 1895, over in the 40-mile country, a prospector named Bob Henderson left Alaska to prospect across the Canadian boundary to the east. Henderson made a small gold strike which drew a few prospectors from the 40-mile region. On one trip to his new discovery, Henderson passed the mouth of the stream where Carmack and his Indian relatives were fishing. The Indians called the stream Slung Puke. The word meant where the stakes are driven, and referred to the fish trap stakes across the mouth of the creek.
When Henderson passed Carmack's fish camp, he invited Carmack to come up to his new discovery and stake some claims. Soon after, Carmack and two of his relatives, Tagus Jim and Skookum Charlie, left their fish camp and headed up to Henderson's Creek. After making poor prospects, they decided it wasn't worth bothering to stake a claim, so they left. Instead of going back along the creek, looping around the mountain, and then back to Slonkoop Creek, they decided to cut over the mountain and come into the headwaters of creeks that flowed into the Slonkoop. Along the way back over the mountain, the story goes, they stopped to hunt a moose. After cleaning the moose and washing up, one of the members of George Carmack's party took his gold pan and scooped up some dirt.
He panned down the dirt, and gold gleamed in the bottom. It was rich pay. Carmack headed for the nearest recorder's office right away to 40 Mile. There he recorded the discovery claims for himself and his two Indian partners. The creek flowed into the Slung Puke, and thus the entire region came to be known as the Klondike.
Government records show that there were about 1,500 men in the Yukon Basin at that time. At first, they were skeptical about the claims of Carmack, but gradually news of the big strike could not be ignored. When it was accepted as truth, men from up and down the Yukon hit the trail for Klondike Creek. A surveyor laid out the town site where the creek flowed into the Yukon and named it after his boss, who was head of the Canadian Geological Survey, Dr. George M. Dawson. Thus, in 1896, the town of Dawson came into being, the summer after Carmack's strike in the Klondike.
During the summer and winter of 1896, and into the spring of 1897, miners worked the frozen ground. They thawed it slowly with small fires, removed the dirt from the holes they thawed, and finally washed the dirt to concentrate the heavy gold.
In the summer of 1897, the first Klondike miners shipped their gold dust down the Yukon River to St. Michael's. Then it was transferred to two ships sailing for Seattle and San Francisco.
The ship Excelsior arrived in San Francisco on July 16, 1897, and the ship Portland arrived in Seattle on July 17, 1897. Both ships carried Klondike miners, who told stories of the most fabulous gold bonanza in history. With the miners lay proof of their stories. Each ship carried over $750,000. In gold dust and nuggets. Stores in Seattle and San Francisco set up displays in their windows showing nuggets and dust, and wireless messages flashed the news of the Klondike strike to newspapers around the nation. On July 17th and 18th, morning papers from San Francisco to New York thrilled readers with the story that millions of dollars worth of gold was waiting to be taken from the Klondike region. In every port in the Northwest, extra ships were pulled on to the Alaska Run, and within a matter of days, every ship was booked beyond capacity. The rush was on.
That was over 70 years ago. Few men live today to tell, firsthand, the story of the greatest rush for gold and the Klondike Trail. Many who came soon left, disappointed because the richest ground had already been staked. They were too late, and all that was left for them was to work for laborers' wages. Others turned back before they ever reached the gold fields, unable to endure the hardships of the trail.
Some gold seekers sailed from the Northwest to St. Michael, where they continued to Dawson by riverboat up the Yukon. Most sailed to the head of the Lynn Canal, either to Dyea or to Skagway. Two trails led to the Yukon from the head of the Lynn Canal. One of the trails was over the Chilkoot Pass, named after the Indians who controlled ancient trade routes between the coastal and interior Indians. The other trail was developed as an alternate route for the gold seekers. It was called the White Pass Route at first. Later it was called the Dead Horse Trail. Hundreds of horses died in the summer and fall of 1897, exhausted from wading through quagmire or toppling from sheer rocky slopes. Some men, however, felt that the White Pass Trail was easier than the Chilkoot, because the Chilkoot Trail climbed nearly straight up, over a 3,000-foot mountain. The trail wound upward beneath great snowfields, which occasionally slid off, and avalanches buried men and horses in the valley below. Either trail was enough to turn a man back.
One man who did make the climb over the Chilkoot Pass and who remained to be an Alaskan pioneer is Tony Trocek. Tony was born in 1873 in Norway. He came from Trondheim, Norway, when he was 19, to North Dakota, where he had relatives. 6 years later, the news of the Klondike spread. Tony, 25 at that time, his brother and a friend, all decided that times in the States were depressed, and this might offer new opportunities for them. So in the winter of 1897-98, they hit the trail for the Klondike. Tony Trocek was interviewed at the Pioneer's home in Fairbanks just before he celebrated his 98th birthday in July of 1971.
I came up in 1898. Oh, that's a story, you know that. My experience is since I left North Dakota, Hillsboro. My brother and another young fellow from home went together. And I left Hillsboro, North Dakota in January 98. In 98, we went to Tacoma and outfitted for the Tacoma one lumber company. They were Klondike outfit. And that's where we bought the outfit and left Seattle for Tacoma, rather, on the city of Seattle on the 26th of January in 98 and took off for the Klondike. The three of us, my brother and another boy and us. So we left it in Starie, not Skagit. We come to Skagit and then we changed over to and went to Starie. And we hit the Starie Trail. Walked over the Chilkoot Pass and dropped into the Yukon from through the lake and river. And landed in Stewart Island about 70, 80 miles above Dawson on the Yukon. And that's where we done our first practice. And then we went to Dawson the following 98. That's about 70 miles across. Stewart Island's about 70, 80 miles above Dawson on the Yukon River. And that's where we done our first practice. That's on the Essen Creek up there. And we went to Dawson the following 98. And stayed there. And first, and later on, then some mining.
We asked Tony why he thought the Klondike Rush swept the country with such force.
Times are hard in the United States. In anything that could develop, they were ready for it.
Some people believed that the stampede was actually a promotion by the outfitting companies in Tacoma and Seattle. Some writers suggested that the newspapers deliberately sensationalized the news to cause the rush for the benefit of the companies who sold supplies to the prospectors. There may be little evidence to support the accusation. Nevertheless, the business of outfitting for gold seekers became a big one. As Tony Trocek said, he and his brother and their companion went to Tacoma where they purchased their outfit. A typical outfit consisted of hundreds of pounds of supplies, winter clothing, camping gear, mining equipment, and foodstuffs. It all had to be packed in heavy, waterproof canvas duck, Tony said.
We bought stores and provisions to live on, grub, and it had to be packed in a heavy, sail duck canvas. So it wouldn't get ruined. You had to throw them in the snow there.
Water was not such a threat to ruining provisions in the winter when Tony went north. It was the heavy snow over Chilkoot Pass.
and covered about covered up by 7 feet of snow on the Chilkoot Pass.
Tony Trofus continues to tell us about conditions over Chilkoot Pass in 1898. He explains that it was steep, but there was a line of rope to hang on to, and there were steps cut in the snow. Men relayed their packs to the top of the pass, then cast them in the snow until all of their supplies were at the top. Then they began again and started relaying their supplies down to the next leg of the trail, where they hit Lake Bennett and Lake Labarge, then continued on down to the Yukon River. Some men packed their supplies over the ice all the way to Dawson. Others waited on the Yukon upriver until spring came. After the ice went out, they sailed every imaginable craft to the Klondike. But listen to Tony tell about Chilkoot Pass.
It was steep, you know. But you had a line, a rope to hang on to. Had steps, you know, cut in the snow. Just like a step ladder. And when you got on top, of course, you cast it in the snow along the trail until you got it all up there and so on. Until you got to the lakes, of course, then you traveled on the lakes, on the ice. And then, of course, when the ice went out, then you had a boat. Traveled on the Yukon line to Dawson.
Mr. Trofus and his brother and companion were like many of the prospectors who arrived in the Klondike to find claim stakes marked the ground for miles in all directions. The Trofus group worked at the Stewart River area first, about 80 miles above Dawson. Then later on, Tony said, he worked on one of the richest claims in the Klondike. It was the number 16 Eldorado. He worked there digging for 3 winters. Each spring, the men washed the gravel through the sluice boxes to recover the gold. But here's Tony again.
I'll say that much. I worked on the richest claim in the Klondike. I seen 10 mules loaded up with gold dust in the spring of 99. We worked on the claim for veggies. My partner and I, my brother was going to Connecticut, loaded down to 10, 11 mules with gold dust that we cleaned up in the spring.
10 to 11 mules loaded to capacity with sacks of gold. What a sight.
That was the number 16 Eldorado. Another claim not far away was the source of a story that has the qualities of legend.
At 40 Mile, the story goes, a Swedish miner, Charles Anderson, worked hard for wages and struggled to save his money. He had $600. One day, Anderson was drunk, and two prospectors, fresh from the Klondike, came through 40 Mile. The two prospectors thought they'd staked a worthless claim. When they saw Anderson, they decided to sell their Klondike claim to him. They figured they'd be $600 richer. So while he was drunk, Anderson bought their claim. It was the number 29 on El Dorado Creek.
The next day, Anderson woke up with a headache, his $600 gone, and what was presumed to be a worthless claim. He went to the prospectors and asked for his money back, but they laughed at him. They were going on up the Quartz Creek to prospect there, they said, and they left.
Anderson decided he had only one thing to do, to test out his claim. So he packed up his things and told his friends at 40 Mile he was off to his number 29 in El Dorado, 80 miles away. "I think I go to work," he said.
None of the ground around number 29 showed good prospects, but Anderson was not like his neighbors who took shallow samples and gave up. Undaunted, he dug. He dug deeper than anyone else. He dug a hole to 18 feet, and there he hit bedrock.
As the story goes, Anderson was just panning down a sample from bedrock when the two prospectors who sold him the claim walked up. They were on their way back to Dawson from Quartz Creek. They thought they'd stop by and see what happened to poor old Anderson.
There he was, washing down gravel, when the two men came up. They watched. Hunks of yellow flashed. Anderson looked up at them. "I think I got some gold here," he said.
The prospectors who thought they'd pulled a fast deal when they sold the claim for $600 were looking at a single pan that contained over $1,400 in gold. Eventually, Anderson's number 29 Eldorado produced $1.25 million.
Such flamboyant rise to riches was not everyone's destiny. Men who arrived after the surrounding creeks were staked had 3 alternatives: to go to work for someone else, to go on to another region, or to return home.
Other strikes were made. There were many stampedes to new gold fields, to Bettles on the Koyukuk, to Nome on the Seward Peninsula, And, of course, Felix Pedro's discovery here in the Valley of the Tanana, followed by Clary, and so on.
Tony said his brother made the rush to Koyukuk, too, but he stayed behind at Dawson to work for wages, and then... But here is Tony again.
Well, we got prospects, so it's just we didn't make any money. No, we made our money over here at Clary's. Thank you, Mark.
Tony stuck it out and did make it in the north when others headed back south. Tony said he made the rush to Nome also, but the trip was overcome by trouble. The final blow, Tony said, was when a herd of caribou trampled their claim stakes. But Cleary Creek, where Tony finally hit pay dirt, was a major gold-producing center. It was developed after the early rush to Pedro Creek. Today, Cleary is a ghost town. Like many other mining communities in the western states and Alaska, it was abandoned at the time of World War II. When the Second World War occurred, gold mining generally came to a halt. Heavy equipment was appropriated by the government for the war effort. Many operations were halted while the equipment awaited use and eventually rusted and became unusable. Thus, it became impractical to open the mines again. Nevertheless, by the time of World War II in 1941, the mining operations surrounding Fairbanks had produced over $100 million in gold. Today, above the abandoned town of Cleary, sportsmen enjoy America's farthest north ski resort. At Cleary Summit, skiers slalom over slopes that lead into some of the richest creeks in the Fairbanks area. These creeks, like the streets and landmarks of Fairbanks, ring with the names of the early prospectors and pioneers who first explored this land of inland forests and winding rivers. From Cleary Summit, just below the peak of Pedro Dome, you look to the north, down Cleary Creek. Turning about to look south, you view Pedro Creek, where the first discovery in the Tanana Basin was made. In the town of Fairbanks, Barnett Street is a main artery. And the name Barnett, like Pedro and Cleary, harks to that peculiar quirk of circumstances that brought the town of Fairbanks into existence.
In 1897, E.T. Barnett sailed the Yukon River to Dawson. Ever after, he was called Captain Barnett. But Barnett was a businessman, explorer, and visionary, as well as a sailor of a riverboat. In the mountains at the headwaters of the Tanana River, copper had been discovered and major mining operations were expected to develop in that area. Further, an overland route, called the All-American Trail, led from Valdez to Eagle, that is, from the coast to the interior, and the trail crossed the Tanana River in its upper reaches, near the copper mining area. Barnett foresaw the need for a trading post at this crossing, so in 1901 he shipped 100 tons of trade goods to St. Michael, loaded them aboard a scow called the Lavelle Young, and sailed up the Yukon to the Tanana, then up the Tanana, intent upon reaching the All-American Trail, crossing on the upper Tanana.
About 18 miles above the mouth of the Chena River into the Tanana, a milky, swift river at best, runs even faster over a shallows, the Bates Rapids. When Captain Barnett's scow hit these rapids, he floundered.
High on a hill above the Tanana Valley, a prospector gazed across the valley and was startled to see a plume of smoke rising from the river. Putting his glass to his eye, he identified the smoke as rising from the steamer, the Lavelle Young. He called to his partner, and the two men watched as the steamer nosed into the rapids, faltered, fell back, tried again, and finally turned around and sailed downstream. At the mouth of the Chena, the Lavelle Young nosed about and turned into the smaller waterway. Excitedly, the prospectors raced back toward the scow.
The two prospectors found the Lavelle Young tied to a bank. Captain Barnett welcomed them aboard. The prospectors, Felix Pedro and his partner Tom Gilmore, explained their presence. 3 years before, Pedro said, he had made a strike in the area but had run out of grub, so he had returned to Circle City. Each year since, he said, he had come back to the Tanana Valley looking for his lost mine. He hadn't yet found it or another rich strike, but he had made good prospects. The creek looked promising, Pedro said. Would Barnett set up a post here, he asked.
Barnett agreed, at least, to offload his 100 tons of supplies and to remain through the winter. This would be a good place to cache his supplies, he thought, and he would let the Lavelle Young return with the pilot back to St. Michael. The following year, Barnett planned to return with a shallower, more powerful boat, and continue to navigate upstream to the All-American Crossing. However, with potential development in this area, they would build a post now. Barnett, his wife, and his crew went to work.
Near where the present Cushman Street Bridge now crosses the Chena River, the men erected a cabin for Barnett and his wife. Tents went up to shelter the supplies. Pedro and Gilmore, once again supplied, headed out with full packs to continue prospecting.
Through the winter, Barnett and his party established a good fur trade with the Tanana Indians. In February, Mrs. Barnett's brother, Frank J. Cleary, arrived from the south. He had trekked overland from Valdez. In March, Barnett and his wife left their new trading post under the care of her brother, Cleary. They marched to Valdez with a load of furs bound for the Seattle market and with plans to construct a new boat. This was 1902.
4 months later, in July, Barnett was in St. Michael's assembling another riverboat. A friend of his, the Honorable Judge James Wickersham, arrived at St. Michael's after spending several weeks at Nome settling the dispute now famous in Rex Beach's book, The Spoilers. At St. Michael's, Wickersham told Barnett he planned to establish recorder's offices and mining districts throughout Alaska. Barnett told Wickersham about his plan to sail the new boat, the Isabel, to the headwaters of the Tanana and to set up a new trading post. Wickersham asked Barnett to name his new trading post after a friend, the senator from Indiana, Charles W. Fairbanks. Fairbanks, of course, was later to become vice president.
Meanwhile, back on the creek, on July 27th, Felix Pedro hit pay dirt. Pedro had sunk a hole to bedrock, and now it paid off. The next day, he came into the trading post on the Chena and told Cleary he had hit it big. Cleary headed out to the creek with Pedro, went on over the divide, and began prospecting the next watershed. There were a few men at the trading post, and they agreed to keep the discovery secret. The original claims of discovery were then staked by the men who explored the country first, by Felix Pedro, Frank Cleary, and their companions. Nevertheless, word leaked out, and prospectors began to arrive. In September 1902, Captain and Mrs. Barnett arrived back at the Chena River, set to transfer their goods on up to Tanana. Instead, they found a stampede underway. Barnett changed his plans and decided to remain on the Chena River. He named the new camp after the friend of Wickersham's, as he had been asked, and so the town of Fairbanks was named after Senator, later Vice President, Charles W. Fairbanks.
Thus the town was born. In almost inconceivable haste, buildings grew and business blossomed. While Tony Trofeth is the only pioneer in Fairbanks who recalls the ordeal of the Klondike Trail and the Chilkoot Pass, there are many who tell about life in the wilderness when there were no machines to find you or fly you out, and they can tell you how industry and growth took place. The second in the series, The Sourdough Speak, will bring you conversation with Heine Carson. Heine, who is a remarkable 77 years young, made his third strike in 1966, and he will tell you it is the biggest strike of all. He will tell you how he came to discover his mine under a trail stamped by the boots of hundreds of miners who stampeded to Fairbanks and walked over nuggets as large as walnuts. Conversation with Heine Carson is great fun, so join us in the next broadcast of The Sourdough Speak.
You have been listening to Neville Jacobs and Tom Duncan in a recorded interview with Tony Trofeth. Sourdough Speak is written by Neville Jacobs and produced in the studios of KUAC for the University of Alaska Broadcasting Service.